Welcome to Turn the Page, the official podcast of the Syosset Public Library.
Hello, this is Jessica Chotan.
Hello, this is Megan Fangman.
And we are here with Syosset Libraries Podcast, and we are going to
turn the page.
And today we have a wonderful guest. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Certainly. It's a pleasure to be here. My name is Max Alvarez, and I'm a New York City film historian and author on world cinema history. I give lots of film lectures throughout the tri-state area and elsewhere, and I have a cultural programming background and film curatorial background as well.
That's great. Just to kind of give a little bit of my background, before I became a librarian, I actually was a film theory major in college, and I would like to dedicate actually this episode to my film theory professor, Harris Ross, who actually passed away a few months ago, surprisingly. But So the topic we're going to talk about today is
Alfred Hitchcock.
And just to kind of circle back really quickly, so I was a film theory major, which basically means you can't watch a movie now without cutting it to pieces. And Dr. Ross made me from a scaredy cat who wouldn't touch anything with a little bit of suspense in it to somebody who would watch horror movies and just be like, yeah, I guess that was scary. So once again, thank you, Dr. Ross. And Megan, would you like to just mention your interest in the topic?
Yes. So I've always been a huge fan of Hitchcock's films, and I've watched mostly all of his films, and I've appreciated them for all of their different aspects. And I took a film theory class in college, and that really reawakened my love of the films, and I started to dissect them as I looked and analyzed more into Hitchcock's expertise.
So I would like to ask you then, Dr. Alvarez.
I wish I was a doctor.
Oh, it's Mr. I'm sorry.
I don't mind the promotion, however.
Okay, well,
you can just call me Max.
Max. Okay, so Max, so why don't you tell me a little bit about your interest in Alfred Hitchcock and how you came to this lecture? You wrote a book on the topic as well?
So my interest in Hitchcock stems from the fact of growing up in a film-addicted household to two psychologists' parents, displaced New Yorkers. We were growing up in the Midwest, who just loved cinema and took it very seriously. And so when a Hitchcock movie was shown on television, there was always this, I guess we call it a director's commentary on DVDs today. It was a parental commentary during the entire film. Watch what he does to the camera. Look at the editing here. Look how they're building suspense. And I'm only 11 years old. So that certainly initiated that interest in Hitchcock. And I think Hitchcock in general, even to those who don't study film technique or technology, are aware of the filmmaking devices that he uses for maximum impact. In terms of my own writing, I have written most recently a University Press book on the director Anthony Mann, who's mostly known for his westerns that he made in the 50s and epics in the 60s. But he went through a film noir suspense period in the 40s, and
right. That's
what my book is about.
Oh, very cool. Very nice.
Maybe. And Hitchcock touched on noir occasionally.
But he kind of, his own branding became more of his suspense and horror movies.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting you use the word horror because we often equate Hitchcock with horror, but out of those 50 plus movies, how many could we call horror films?
Well, that's exactly it. And I think that's one of the things that I enjoy about it because for me, I mean, like I mentioned, I was always a scaredy cat. And for me, you know, what's best is the building of suspense. That is what scares me more than your traditional slasher movie, I guess, or whatever. You know, now, I mean, it's changed so much. But Megan, would you like to weigh in?
Yeah, sure. I mean, one of Hitchcock's, I feel like, scariest films is Psycho because of the way that he just builds the tension even from the introduction to that movie or, like, what's going on and the way that the buildup between the symbolism of the prey and the victim movie.
The taxidermy in Norman Bates' office,
Yes, and he uses birds as symbolism in a lot of his horror films, I would say. That was something big part of those films.
Those devices are very, very powerful. And the art of building suspense, it's almost become a lost art because so many things are being done in contemporary entertainment where there's too much editing, there's too much music. Now, granted, Hitchcock, he had Bernard Herrmann, and Bernard Herrmann never met a suspenseful chord that he didn't love.
Yeah.
But building the suspense and setting enough clues for the audience in advance is a skill. Many of Hitchcock's contemporaries who worked in the crime genre were very good at that as well.
Yes.
But it is a skill that we're in danger of losing.
So just talking about Psycho, because before we started recording, Max and I were talking about Psycho. So one of the things that I learned about Psycho, which was interesting, now, before this, from what I understand, you know, when people would watch movies, it was always on a reel and you can kind of come in and leave at your will. But Hitchcock was very adamant that if you come in after the movie starts, you won't be let in. And I believe Psycho is one of our first big movie spoilers, as we would call it.
Hitchcock took a big, and I've talked about this quite a bit when I talk about Hitchcock. He took what I call a page from the William Castle showmanship manual. William Castle directing a lot of the low-budget horror pictures in the 50s with Vincent Price, like The Tingler, who always... He was very big on showmanship in theaters. He may have instituted some you-have-to-be-on-time policies.
I feel like there was a poster, and I'm actually going to try to look it up after this. If I find it, I'm going to put it on our blog post with this.
It's the Psycho?
I believe so. And like I said, I'm gonna look it up because I distinctly remember seeing some poster of him looking very stern and being like, you have to be here.
You're
on
absolutely
time.
Correct. There were what we call standees that were set up in the lobbies. These would have been lifestyle standees of Hitchcock looking at his watch sternly and saying, you must arrive on time. I remember the newspaper ads when I went back and checked them out. They one of the newspaper ads said something to the effect that even the Queen of England will not be allowed.
Okay, so I'm not just imagining.
You're not imagining.
This isn't a Hitchcockian thing that's in my mind.
No.
That
you're absolutely
happened.
Correct. They did that for Psycho. Absolutely.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe there was even a disclaimer in the beginning of the film. This was before films were even rated, and it said something: if you reveal the plot of the film, that.
Oh,
you know,
right.
You do not reveal the plot of this film to anyone, the twists that appears in the movie.
They did that occasionally, very rarely before that. There was a Robert Siodmak film in the 40s called The Strange Affair of Uncle Harry, which at the end, there's a credit saying, please don't reveal the ending if you make it a fresh experience for
people. So a spoiler that predates the Psycho spoiler.
Yes. It happened rarely, but the Psycho was legendary as please don't give away.
And I think another interesting film trivia about the movie, there was never a toilet flushed on film before Psycho. So that was just an interesting tidbit about that film.
You're absolutely correct. We couldn't see them on camera.
Right.
And according to some legends or some stories of Psycho, that's what caused one of the biggest skirmishes with the Hollywood censorship office. Not so much the violence, which didn't help, but it was the presence of the toilet.
And there was also the presence of Janet Leigh's belly button, which was supposedly scandalous.
Jessica, I learned something from you today because I remember the belly button well, but we often associate a film made the following year called Town Without Pity as having broken the belly button barrier and loosened the censorship laws. But you're absolutely right. This Janet Leigh's navel was at a time that you couldn't show that in a film due to the censorship restrictions.
And of course, I guess before we move on from Psycho and just kind of go to something else, the other legend I heard, and I do not know if this is true, was the blood Bosco chocolate syrup, because that is what we were told was the going legend.
I can't vouch for the brand, but I have heard that it was chocolate syrup.
So when you watch Psycho, that's, I guess, the first standee for blood. And I guess it's a famous early splatter film, which is very different from now.
You know, as usual, these directors like Hitchcock and later Sam Peckinpah and others who pushed the violence card, they were doing it for a purpose to
yes.
try to make, and of course every other filmmaker got the wrong message and then ended up using it for purely exploitation purposes, which is unfortunate. But whenever there's somebody taking risks in film, uh-huh. there are going to be others misunderstanding.
I absolutely agree.
I was going to say that his films became less bloody after that. I mean, there certainly is violence in Marnie and the birds.
Well, Marnie, there's Marnie is, I mean, the violence is different, though.
A different kind of
it's
violence,
it's completely
yeah.
different, you know.
But he apparently was, according to one book about the making of Psycho, he was inspired by some of the low-budget drive-in movies that were being made by companies like American International, producers like Roger Corman.
Yes.
And he was wanting to use his TV crew to see, could we make something on a budget? And that's how Psycho originated.
You mentioned the name William Castle. Was he the one who put the props in the movie theaters?
Yes.
That shook the seats and...
He was responsible for the buzzers, for the tingler.
Yeah.
And he was responsible for... there were the thumbs up, the thumbs down if you wanted the character to die or live at the end of the film. And all these devices to get people into the cinema.
That's predating the thumbs up and thumbs down for, you know, like Twitter and Facebook, which... That's pretty, wow. He was ahead of his time.
He was way ahead of his time. He was a great promoter. And he predates Hitchcock in the sense that he actually would appear in the coming attractions previews for his films.
Oh.
And he would interview people online saying, what did you think of this movie? And Hitchcock obviously took a page from that.
Oh, there really is always somebody before...
There are, and Hitchcock was he didn't often share where he got influences from. He claimed not to be influenced, but you do see little things here and there. But that's to be inevitable. That's inevitable if you're going to be a commercial film director.
So, do you have a favorite Hitchcock film or a favorite part of your lecture you would like to share with us?
Favorite Hitchcock film, favorite part of the lecture. Well, Notorious is one that I always revisit. I think the chemistry between the two leads is remarkable. It works on so many levels. It's got a sympathetic yet menacing villain. It's got the menacing mother figure. It's got the political angle. And it's got tremendous suspense. And it works. And the fact that they had a year to prepare and prepare the script, I think, pays off. That's one that I often go to. Favorite part of my lecture right now? Well, there's one is where I break down a sequence. There's to give people an idea of Hitchcock's planning, what I do is I start off with the printed page, an mm-hmm. extract from one of his screenplays, then his hand-drawn sketches, then the storyboards, and then the actual film clips to show an audience how this whole film was created and how a scene evolves, to give us a sense of his planning. That's a favorite part.
Thank you. I will say, I mean, he really did paint an artful picture in his films that way. I think for me, I mean, and maybe this is cliche, but I love Vertigo. I absolutely love it.
It's nice to hear a woman say that.
You know what, though? It was what I love about it is it's such a well put together film. And I love the fact that you go through about 75% of this film thinking there's a supernatural angle, and there isn't. There is a logical, even though it's a little bonkers when you really sit back and think about it, explanation for what was going on. Megan, did you...
Yeah, and I love in Vertigo just the whole way that Hitchcock creates a scene with the dolly effect that he uses.
Yeah,
the vertigo shot, the dolly effect is the actual term for it. Yeah, there's one scene near the end of that film when Jimmy Stewart is trying to climb the tower, the bell tower, and he's just stopping in between each of the stairs, and it's just you yourself as... in the audience, you're feeling that nausea, that vertigo feeling that he's experiencing.
And he did the zoom in and the dolly back.
Yeah,
I always forget what the actual, but it really creates that sense of panic, and it's beautiful.
And it's not in the original screenplay, which is fascinating because the scripts are so detailed. They're like engineering blueprints, but he didn't quite devise how to do that until they were getting closer to production. Vertigo never ceases to fascinate. I remember seeing it as a kid and couldn't understand why I couldn't get it out of my mind for years. And I didn't understand that. And of course, the older I get, the more devastating and poignant this movie is.
Yeah.
And James Stewart's obsession over the Kim Novak character. It's a very impactful film celebrating its 50th anniversary. Correction, 60th anniversary this year.
And you can't leave out Bernard Herrmann's score in that film.
Absolutely.
It makes the entire film.
It's impossible. Well, you can't imagine it without the score, but it's so poignant. And some people think that without the Herrmann music, there would be sections that would be very dull. When he's following her around San Francisco, it's this beautifully laid out sequence, but without music it would be quite slow. But Herman's music, it's very atmospheric and melancholy and haunting and keeps us involved.
One of the most haunting scenes, I feel like, is in the beginning of the film when he first sees Kim Novak sitting in the restaurant and then the camera just pans in. You don't hear anything and then it starts slow and the tension already builds. You feel his obsession. Like,
you definitely do.
And what a perfect place to set it. But San Francisco, where the hills are so high. I mean, you know, you walk down the street in San Francisco and you're on top of this big hill. And you really do kind of get that sense of vertigo. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you've got the Golden Gate Bridge, which is beautiful but notorious for jumpers.
It's a city that inspires vertigo. So that,
yes.
And it's based, of all things, on a French novel. And, of course, he loved buying novels and changing the locale.
I didn't know that. I knew Psycho was Robert Bloch. And I know, he did a few Daphne du Maurier and some Patricia. I had no idea that Vertigo was based on. Thank you for teaching me that.
Not at all. It was Truffaut claimed, and it turned out not to be true, but he claimed that two French writers wanted to sell a story to Hitchcock, so they came up with this novel. And it turns out that Hitchcock bought the rights to it, and he had no idea that they set him up. Apparently, it was not quite that simple. But it was a novel that translates in English to From Amongst the Dead, and that was the working title of the film for quite some time.
Which makes sense, because she is supposed to be this, you know, this past life of, what was it, Carlotta?
Carlotta Valdez.
Carlotta Valdez.
The sad Carlotta.
Right, the sad Carlotta. It really was great. And it really just, you know, one of my friends and I took a walk in the Redwood Forest years ago, and we saw that tree with the different rings, and my friend goes over and points to one ring, and she says, I was born here, and I died here. So really, I mean, if you've seen that movie, it sticks with you.
There was a wonderful book that was written in the late 90s called The Making of Alfred Hitchcock's Vertigo, by, I want to say, Dan Mulday. I could be wrong. But anyway, it was very, very haunting piece of data. He tracked down the original production records for the shooting of that film, where Scotty follows Madeline to that mission.
Yeah.
If you look at that scene, there's all this filtration on the camera. Hitchcock wasn't, and I remember one time I saw it in a theater with a friend. He said, that's strange, because Hitchcock really doesn't use color filters. He didn't. It was the lighting. It was the actual real lighting of this. Because if you look at the production report, which indicates lenses and filters, there was no filtration. It was all the atmosphere that captured that. I thought that was remarkable.
Definitely. In your lecture, do you talk at all about, his transition to TV?
We touch about that a little bit, and I think that's an aspect of his work that's been underrated, even though he himself, ironically, the best episodes were not directed by Hitchcock. But there was some wonderful work, and it certainly deals with themes that he couldn't deal with for features, because he was dealing with much bigger budgets, bigger actors, which means you have to have more of a upbeat structure to the narrative, whereas the stories, and he admitted this at the time, with what he liked about television is an episode did not have to end happily. He could really take some risks.
How much do you think he was influenced or not at all by The Twilight Zone?
I would say it was the other way around because Twilight Zone came after.
It's it, right, it's
so
it. Okay.
Hitchcock goes on the air in 55. Twilight Zone, I want to say 59.
Yes, with
And Twilight Zone, Rod Serling, may he rest in peace. However, he did get ideas from others, including series such as One Step Beyond. But Hitchcock came first.
Yes, okay.
And then the Alfred Hitchcock Hour, which came after Alfred Hitchcock Presents, has some really wonderful, powerful segments, not directed by him, but by others.
You know, I actually completely forgot that the Alfred Hitchcock Hour was separate from Alfred Hitchcock Presents.
And the frustrating part, it's hard to find. It would be nice if Universal finally put it out in a DVD collection. But you do see some neo-noir themes there. You do see some really interesting character studies. Very, very complex, high-quality stuff.
Because, I mean, I know Megan and I have mentioned this several times. I mean, I could probably rattle off about 10 Twilight Zone episodes.
Yes.
Yeah, but Alfred Hitchcock Presents, I mean, I watched it on Nick at Night, but I hate to say it's a muddle, but it's a muddle.
Well, it does. Sometimes it gets muddled. I mean, you have there are the different themes, the constant recycling of arsenic and old lace. You know, usually an elderly woman who poisons the man who's visiting. There's a little bit of that, but you do have sometimes some neo noirish type dramas there. You do have some powerful social statements. There was one my wife and I were watching recently with Rip Torn, who thinks it's kind of cool to get arrested and be on a police lineup after he's been arrested for robbing a store, and he's not aware that the man in the robbery he killed. And at the end, there were a couple of times when Hitchcock at the end of the episode came on to say, normally I would make some kind of a sarcastic quip, but I can't, this is not appropriate, and I hope somewhere this film will be helpful to someone. And there was another one, a very devastating one, about a woman alcoholic that Hitchcock had the same response at the end.
I wish that is it available anywhere?
It is. The first five seasons are available on DVD.
Okay.
So Universal's put those out. We're still waiting for season six and beyond. There's one that I've always wanted to see that he directed with Billy Mummy, called Bang You're Dead.
You know, pretty much anytime Billy Mummy is in any of these, is it Mummy or Mummy?
I should have looked that up before.
Yes.
I always say Mummy.
Anytime he's in any of these anthology horror shows, because he did two episodes of Twilight Zone that I'm remembering, right?
I mean,
he does the super creepy kid thing really well.
And in this Hitchcock directed episode, it's called Bang You're Dead, where he gets a hold of a gun and is walking around the neighborhood playing with it and pointing at people, and they have no idea it's a real gun. So that's a theme that, can you imagine, that resonates very much today.
I would say that's still very relevant.
Yes.
Unfortunately.
Yes, and even I'm thinking back to the Twilight Zone being influenced by Hitchcock, The Monsters Are Due on Maple Street,
That's a fantastic episode.
Just thinking of that when you mentioned the episode with the gun and he's pointing at other people, they think the kid is the one that knows about the aliens coming, and then the other people just start like...
It's about public panic, which I know they do a lot of that. Serling used a lot of that theme.
Yeah, but that was the 50s.
Yeah, that was the 50s.
It was all panic.
And the thing is, like, it's always funny because, like, I'll watch these episodes and some of them, you know, I'll be like, oh, that's not scary. But at the time, it was probably terrifying.
You know, you're watching this thing on a Sunday night in your living room. It does get under your skin. And some of them, because of the psychological themes, get under your skin, even if they're done in the context of artificiality, whether it's clearly something is a set or a backlot. But we do see elements coming out in Hitchcock, even in some of the stuff he directed that didn't appear in his films.
Now, other Hitchcock films that have, I guess, made their way into pop culture, Strangers on a Train?
Yes. The Patricia Highsmith novel that he made an adaptation of in 1951, the first half hour of that almost counts as somewhat of a film noir, and then as you indicated, it kind of goes in another direction, as Hitchcock sometimes did. Had he remained more faithful to the Highsmith novel, it would have been a film noir.
So for me, the
strongest part is that first half hour, these two men meeting on the train, and one of them mistakenly thinking the other is joking about committing a murder. But that's Hitchcock at his best.
And that's been, you know, spoofed over and over again and reused. But really, I mean, it is a really cool setup for that type of...
Well, Highsmith was fascinated by unhealthy relations between men. We have, like, the talented Mr. Ripley, Ripley's Game.
Ripley is terrifying. Yeah, that was really good.
Exactly. So that, I think, Strangers on a Train is fascinating. And I think Robert Walker's performance is what really makes it stand out.
One of my favorite film noir films of Hitchcock is Shadow of a Doubt.
Oh, yes.
That has to be my favorite. And there's this whole aspect talking about spooky things and horror again that people mention is the uncle really a vampire. I don't know if you've ever heard that's in film. I know this has been studied, but one of the first scenes you see him and he's in this closed, completely sunlit, empty room and he just kind of appears like...
He could be in a casket.
That's the way it starts off. So I didn't know if you had heard that theory or not.
That's an original one. I have not, because this was written during the World War II years. He's the Charlie character played by Joseph Cotten is seen as symbolic of fascism, in a way the fascist threat coming to our small towns. I actually did a lot of research on the writing of that and contributed to a book that came out 4 years ago called Thornton Wilder New Perspectives. And my section has to do with the writing of Shadow of a Doubt. And I was so lucky that I had access to Thornton Wilder's initial handwritten drafts of the script and was able to do a comparative study. But there's so much there. Mm-hmm. There is this noirish element which Hitchcock offsets with a comedy of manners. And I've always believed had he made the film in the 50s, it would have been even darker. Yes. But that's just, he was pretty new to the United States at that time. But that is, I believe he considered that his personal favorite. And it could be that, as one of his writers pointed out, the finished product is not that different from the original written script, that there wasn't a lot of changes that had to be made.
So before we wrap up, would you like to talk a little bit about his work with, is it David O. Selznick?
David O. Selznick, that is one of the dullest collaborations I can think of. I mean, I'm grateful to David O. Selznick for bringing him to Hollywood. It was a 7-year contract, but they really only worked on 3 films together. They did Rebecca, which is very nicely done.
Which is also another Du Maurier.
Yes, although Hitchcock considered it more of a Selznick production. He didn't really feel it was his own project.
Right.
They worked on Spellbound, which has its issues, if it's kind of works on a kitsch level. And then there was the Paradigm Case, which many people have trouble staying awake during, although it has memorable moments. It was when Hitchcock was loaned out to others during that time. That's when he made Notorious. That's when he made Shadow of a Doubt.
Right.
That's when he made Lifeboat and these other interesting films.
Oh, Lifeboat, yeah.
Lifeboat, which I think is underrated.
Yeah, I
saw that a few years ago.
One.
The Lowe's Jersey brought that to the big screen, and I was blown away by how effective a movie that is. So Selznick was very hands-on as a producer, and Hitchcock was getting stifled. And so the minute the contract expired, Hitchcock said, I'm my own producer now. And then he never looked back.
That's interesting. So Selznick's, I think it was either his grandnephew or somebody, one of his descendants has gone on to write The Invention of Hugo Cabret, which is a beautifully written, an illustrated children's book about George Millay, I believe.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's very...
Martin Scorsese made a film out of. Hugo.
Yes, Hugo. The Invention of Hugo Cabret was originally Hugo, which is beautiful. And
beautiful
I recommend
film.
It to adults and children, really. It's very nice. And it's a good thing to read together with a family.
And it ties in many ways to what I've talked about for Hitchcock, because Méliès, the silent filmmaker, Hitchcock started out as a silent filmmaker.
Yes.
And he learned to tell a story visually.
So do you see any of Hitchcock's influence in any current directors?
Current directors? I was hoping you'd say previous ones.
Or previous ones, please. Just,
well, there were directors who did their Hitchcock films. There was Claude Chabrol in France who forged a wonderful career making tense, unpleasant psychological thrillers about the bourgeoisie. He definitely had a Hitchcockian influence and was making films well into the 2000s. And I understand he did have a cult following at one time, bigger than he should have, but I know Brian De Palma liked to claim the Hitchcock influence. I just never saw it. I just saw a lot of copying. It's a difference between copying techniques and getting to the source of what a director is trying to do. I think I would say Scorsese has been influenced by Hitchcock in terms of the planning and the technical innovation.
I could definitely see that. He builds, yeah. I mean, the way that he structures his films are just built so well. You don't realize what he's doing until he does it, and it's great.
And it's very about much the planning. And he of course, used Bernard Herrmann, at least officially on Taxi Driver that one time, reused his music for Cape Fear. But the planning elements, I would say, I imagine, even though he makes completely different kinds of films in terms of the planning and telling stories visually, I also think Spielberg was influenced as well, although I prefer Hitchcock stuff.
You know, it's funny because Spielberg, I mean, growing up a child of the 80s, I always found children's movies to be frightening in the 80s. I mean,
I found them scary in the 60s.
But it's funny because, you know, like sometimes people will be like, oh, don't you think that Disney movie is scary? And I'm like, listen, I grew up on The NeverEnding Story. That was scary. E.T. was scary.
E.T. was, yes. No, I think children's entertainment in general, and Hitchcock would half jokingly mm-hmm. say, what are you blaming me for? Have you ever read The Brothers Grimm?
Uh-huh.
Have you ever read the classic children's stories in their original form? They were very violent and dark, and often they had to be cleaned up when they were turned into animated features.
Absolutely. I know for myself, I going on from Hitchcock and film theory, I found myself really drawn to Sam Raimi. He does some fun things with his camera.
Yes, he does. And I remember, so Sam Raimi... He was very inventive with his camera before he, and then of course he became very big with
Spider-Man.
Right,
which of course then things changed.
Then things changed.
Not that I didn't, I enjoyed the first two Spider-Men, but you know,
But Sam Raimi was inventive with the camera, and I think, Mel Brooks, who once satirized Hitchcock with High Anxiety, he said, every director owes him something. And I think there's something to be said for that when you move the camera or do something in a way, you're owing something to Hitchcock's legacy.
Do you have any feelings on, are you familiar with Dario Argento?
Well, you talk about being scared. I've usually been too much of a chicken to see a lot of his films. I have seen
his
Suspiria.
Suspiria is beautiful and frightening.
And I saw The Bird with the Crystal Plumage. Argento, great stylist.
Yeah.
Very different. He evolved into what, and the Italians listening, I hope, will forgive me, is it the Giallo school of very violent horror?
Yeah, his stuff definitely falls more into gory.
And I'm a total coward when it comes to that stuff. As we see in Suspiria, he is great at generating suspense.
I mean, generally, I don't think the gore is necessary.
Exactly.
Although in Suspiria, he works it really well. The only problem I always have with Argento is the end of his movies just do not work for me. They kind of fall apart in the last 10 minutes. Maybe it was just me.
Endings are probably the hardest
things to stick,
especially for anything involving suspense or horror, to make an ending that's going to work. And in many ways, I think that the horror film and the suspense movie suffered terribly when the end credits got so long.
Uh-huh.
Because imagine how powerful is it Psycho, and I'm not giving it away for people who haven't seen it. It's just, you see a shot and it just says the end, and there's a graphic and it's over. There's not these long credits that go on, and it's the lights are up.
Yep. And I remember hearing from my parents who saw it firsthand, you know, there was just a collective gasp and that was it, folks.
Psycho was Hitchcock's most commercially successful film. Mm-hmm. I would argue it was the beginning of his downfall. It was too successful. Had it just been a small little horror picture, he could have gone on, but it was so huge. And then I think people had these expectations and I think he felt trapped after that.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. This was great.
Thank you, Jessica. Thank you, Megan.
Thank you.
And we are going to close this chapter of
Turn the Page.
It's time to close this chapter of Turn the Page. Join us for the next episode.
there. We're recording right now. Are we recording?
I guess, yeah.
Yeah, we're recording.